Welcome, folks, to a very significant episode of America Trends with your friends Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik.
Yeah, we should have a party.
Why, John?
Why? Because this is our 100th episode.
100 episodes 100. In.
Yes.
Wow, we've had some incredible guests, haven't we, John?
We have. Incredible. You got to go back and listen. If you haven't heard them, they're great.
And they are there for posterity. So please go back and check them out. And I am so proud of a lot of the work and these best-selling authors, Pulitzer Prize winners, some of the great thinkers. I mean, we have been able to attract all of them to America Trends.
I think you should binge listen to this.
All right. Well, that's a good idea. But John, I will say this honestly. And we've been looking over the landscape of podcasting, and it's a growing field. It's gaining in momentum. But I don't think there are too many podcasts that can claim that they have been able to produce 100 episodes in the course of just about 8 or 9 months. We've done it with a lot of discipline and determination for you. We're hoping that going just a bit over the horizon is meeting your needs at this very unique time in American history. So here we go. This being episode 100, and we're looking at the Pentagon today.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, John Krofcik and Larry Rifkin, and it's a battle in the podcast trenches. And John, I like to think of it as mouth-to-mouth combat. What do you think about that?
I didn't realize it had come down to mouth-to-mouth
combat. Oh, it's down to that. Oh, there are so many podcasters. We're all vying for your fealty, for your loyalty, your subscription. And it's something like ear wars that's going on out there.
Have
you ever heard that?
Yeah, no, I like ear
wars. We should coin that phrase.
We should coin the ear
wars. How are we doing in the battle for air wars? Well, you tell us. But I will tell you that as it relates to general warfare, the United States hasn't been doing terribly well lately, John. I mean, when was the last time that outright we actually won a war?
Oh, boy. I guess maybe Korea, World War II?
Well, Korea, we still have not finished it.
That's true.
It's still open-ended. Yeah. There's no armistice. There's no treaty. And, of course, we're still at war with North Korea in many ways. But you look at it, it was really World War II, I guess we could say. And you wonder, did we, following Vietnam, and then, of course, following the fall of the Berlin Wall, whether, in fact, when we didn't have a counterweight, the bad guy, the one in the black hat, like Bullwinkle and Boris and Natasha, you need that, right?
You need white that hat, balance. Black yes, hat, right? I think you're right.
So
it gave us something to focus on.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So we've lost our focus, seemingly, in the world. And our next guest, John, is really, really interesting. His name is Mark Perry. And he has been looking for a long time at the way that the Pentagon operates. Now, we've heard a lot about the Pentagon and all the wasteful spending that goes on there,
right. All
the pet projects. And here we are in a state where we have all Democratic congressmen and senators, and yet they haven't met a defense project they don't like because we're a defense-laden state.
Right. They bring the jobs and they get reelected.
So regardless of whether regardless. They're hawks or doves, they spend a lot of money. So has the Pentagon really lost its way? But he's offering really a very interesting thesis in this discussion that we have and the book that he's written about Pentagon's wars. And that is the fact that there is this divide between the military and the civilian leadership here in the United States. And it's something that he has evidenced happening for a very long period of time.
Yeah, well, I think the guys got to get together, and because, man, we're spending a lot of money on defense spending, and not even these black budgets we don't even know about are being spent. So, you know, hopefully somebody can come to grips with this.
Well, when you think about it, John, I mean, we've had a really strong conventional force over so many years, and yet we're fighting these strange characters like Kim Jong-un, or in the past, Saddam Hussein, or guerrilla actors like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And so it's not really that type of warfare any longer that America has been accustomed to and so profoundly good at over the years.
Well, I don't know. You know, I sort of wonder if a lot of these affairs we're getting into, we didn't kind of help to bring upon ourselves, you know, through, you know, corporations and such. So,
oh, yeah, we've talked about that in the past.
We've talked about that.
And let's be honest, I mean, that does go on. And now, of course, there's another point of reference that we want to leave you with today when you think about Pentagon spending and the defense budget and the Pentagon itself. And that is the fact that there is this divide. According to Mark Perry in his book, The Pentagon Wars, the military's undeclared war against American presidents. Now, have you ever thought about that?
No, I haven't. That's bizarre.
I know. It's a very different way of looking at this. But Mark Perry has been studying this for the last 3 decades, John. And he sees some really fascinating conflicts, and he explains how they came about. And maybe that's why sometimes I think we as Americans today, we scratch our heads. We're so removed from the military, so few people involved any longer because it is not a volunteer force.
Right.
And many of us just say, well, you know, these are professionals, let them do what they do. And we're kind of removed a little bit from the military, I think, in ways that may not be helpful in terms of our government and our structure the way it works.
Well, plus for every military person who's volunteering, I think I read somewhere there's 10 support staff to 10
private contractors
to support him.
Well, we've outsourced a lot of this. And yeah, I mean, you see, that's part of what we'll be discussing with Mark Perry today, because there's a lot of tension going on between our civilian government and our military. He describes how we got here. He names names. And he provokes us to think about what our place in the world really should be. And you know, John, when Congress doesn't vote to go to war anymore, when these appropriations that you talk about are off the books, when a lot of folks don't think that their kids are ever going to serve because they're not required to, it really puts a space between the military and the civilian population that, again, can be injurious, I think, over time.
Well, plus there's nothing in the news. The news media, it's invisible. So we don't even know, except for maybe something in the paper occasionally, we don't even know what's going on.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, I once asked on a radio program, folks, do you ever think about what's happening today in Afghanistan or in Iraq? Even though we've been in these hot conflicts for so many years, who really thinks about it? Out of sight? Out of mind.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to bring it to the top of mind right now. And we talk to Mark Perry. The book, again, is called The Pentagon Wars. And we're going to discuss a lot of things, including whether the all-volunteer army has too far distanced us from the consequences of military action. Now, I think you're going to want to hear this. Well, with us on the line, The Pentagon Wars author, Mark Perry. And Mark, I've got to tell you, that just your subtitle alone would get anyone's attention. The military's undeclared war against America's presidents. That seems awfully treasonous. Explain to us what you were trying to get across in this really compelling book.
Well, I think there's always been tension. There always has been tension between our civilian leaders and our senior military officers, but it's been it's escalated in the wake of the end of the Cold War, where American foreign policy and, frankly, American military policy has seemed to be adrift. And the military has snapped back pretty hard against the civilian leadership on a number of cases in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, and generally on the war on terrorism. So my purpose in the book was to kind of lay bare these differences in this growing chasm between civilian military leadership, civilians and the military leadership from the end of the Cold War, from the fall of the Berlin Wall until the present.
And how much does this chasm that you're talking about, or schism, really relate to the fact that we haven't won outright anything since World War II?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with it. It's a good point. We continue to fight conflicts that are of uncertain nature, that last a long period of time against elusive enemies that don't fight big conventional battles like our military is trained to fight. And it's caused us enormous problems, with the result that we had a very uncomfortable end to the Iraq War. We didn't follow up in killing Osama bin Laden and destroying Al-Qaeda when we had a chance in Afghanistan. We became mired in an endless conflict against ISIS. And recently we've seen four of our soldiers die in Niger, and I think many Americans didn't even know we were there or where it is. So these uncertain conflicts have raised the level of discomfort between civilian leaders and our military leaders, and I think we're starting to see the results of it very publicly. Many, many more American people are questioning the endless nature of these wars and whether the country can afford them.
Well, even Donald Trump, I mean, one of the things that he would say among many things during the 2016 campaign was that he didn't want a nation build, and he thought we were spread around the world in ways that were not putting America first. So that was one of his clarion calls.
Yeah, it was, and it resonated with the American military. I was just reading a poll the other day that showed that 80% of all service members voted for him. And of that number, 70% said the reason they did so is because he opposed nation building. And we noticed that when he gave a national address on the new strategy for Afghanistan, he assured the American public that we were going to go after the enemy, that we weren't going to involve ourselves in nation building. This has been kind of a lightning rod of discontent on the military, that we send our young men and women overseas to fight enemies and then to build the governments that we set out to destabilize. And for them, it doesn't make any sense. They're not trained to do it. They're not good at doing it. They think it ought to be someone else's job. And that's made a difference in how people look at our military, and it certainly made a difference in how the military views our politicians. I find it extraordinary that 80% of those serving in uniform voted for Donald Trump, but that's exactly what happened.
We need to go back, because there's also another underpinning to all of this. In fact, two things that occurred that you trace us back to in terms of this rift between the civilian leadership and the military. And I'll tell you, as informed as I think I am, these are things that have escaped my thought process, and I would imagine most Americans. One is what is called the Revolution in Military Affairs, that act. Tell us what that was about.
The Revolution in Military Affairs, shorthand in the military, is RMA. It started in the 1970s when senior defense thinkers realized that we could never match the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War in the numbers of tanks, in the numbers of aircraft, in the sheer number of soldiers that we could put on the ground. They were always going to be able to outnumber us. And they were always going to be able to have more weapons. But these military thinkers thought they couldn't have better weapons. So we started putting a lot of money into high-tech weapons, stealth fighters, night vision equipment, networked infantry brigades, very high-tech, computer-oriented digital networks that would help our men and women fight. And we knew that this revolution in military affairs would spur the Soviet Union to spend money that they didn't have to match us. And it was the revolution in military affairs, I think, that really brought about the end of the Cold War. The Soviet Union and the Communist bloc just realized they couldn't compete. They were going broke doing so. They had to refocus on their economy. So I know that people say, well, Ronald Reagan won the Cold War, but by my lights, and I lay this out in as much detail as possible in the book, we out-technologized, we out-thought, We out-modernized the Soviet military, and that's what brought the end of the Cold War. We bankrupted them. That's really what the revolution in military affairs was about.
But how aware was Ronald Reagan of this strategy that the military had put forward? And he had to approve authorize the funds for this along with Congress.
Well, remember that Star Wars, the Ronald Reagan signature defense program, was a part of the revolution on military affairs. I think he was very aware of it. Certainly his Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, was aware of it. He was more than willing to spend the money on these high-tech programs. And there were a number of defense thinkers who went to Weinberger and to Reagan and to the senior military at the time and said, this is the way to go. They bought into the program. They embraced it. Even if Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense at the time, was very much a skeptic, this was the revolution that defense thinkers led and that we promoted, and I think it was a very purposeful policy. It's one of the really great untold stories of the end of the Cold War is how we bankrupted the Soviet Union, brought down the Berlin Wall simply by being more technologically adept and focusing on research and development of these high-tech weapons.
Now, it would seem that in an era when we're not seeing pitched battles between fixed army positions, that some of this technology would serve us well in a period of asymmetrical warfare, which is primarily what we've been fighting since, and not another large nation state. But why has that technology or our technological edge not necessarily done the trick in these new ways of warfare?
That's really a great question, and it's at the heart of the problems we face. I think that this revolution in military affairs has, in fact, served us well, and especially in terms of the intelligence we gather on a potential adversary or on an insurgent group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. We're able to spot where they are, know where they are, photograph where they are, and plan strikes against them. But your second point is also true. It doesn't seem to have worked totally. And the reason for that is that in all counterinsurgencies, the one thing that is the most important factor is that the people we're fighting are from there, and we're not. They know these societies. They move in and out of these societies. They're able to hide very adeptly. And, you know, the technology that we've adapted and that we've adopted is open to them, too. They don't have drones, of course. They don't have B-2 bombers. But they have night vision goggles, and they have good weapons, and they can use the same kind of high-tech decoys that we use. So we're always scrambling to come up with the newest and the best, but we're also scrambling to figure out why it doesn't make the ultimate bit of difference. And I think the reason comes down to, this is really simple, a lot of these wars are very, very political, not based on technology. And if you don't win the battle of politics, if you don't win the hearts and minds, you can't win the war.
Mark Perry is with us. The book is called The Pentagon Wars, The Military's Undeclared War Against America's Presidents. And let's talk about the second thing that I didn't know about, that most people don't know about, and that was called the Goldwater-Nichols Department of Defense Reorganization Act in the 1980s. So why is that a bedrock of some of the problems we have today?
Well, this goes back, a lot of our listeners might remember, we had real difficulty among the military services, that is between the Army and the Marines and the Air Force and the Navy, very fundamental problems. They couldn't communicate with each other on the battlefield. And in the Pentagon, they were also at odds with each other about budgets and promotions and ranks and influence. And this was real inter-service war, and it impeded America's ability to fight on the battlefield effectively. So in 1986, Senator Barry Goldwater and Congressman Nichols got together and decided that they would reorganize our military along more efficient lines. They would make it a requirement for promotion that an Army colonel know something about the Air Force and serve with Air Force officers, or that a Marine would rub shoulders with an Army colonel, or that a Navy and Air Force people would coordinate more closely, that purchases of weapons would be coordinated more closely, that there would be joint, what is called joint warfighting ability. And the Reorganization Act also changed the way that the military relates to the commander-in-chief, to the president. It used to be that the chain of command went from the president to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Now the president, the chain of command goes from the president through the Secretary of Defense to the combatant commanders, that is, the geographic commanders in the field. I think it's been an amazing, talk about a revolution in military affairs. That was the real revolution in military affairs, was Goldwater Nichols. It's been very effective. It's kind of flattened out and dampened the inter-service rivalry. It's made more efficient the chain of command. And I think in the years since 1986, Goldwater Nichols has been a real success. I would add one thing. While the chain of command no longer runs through the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, under the legislation, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is the principal military advisor to the president. So in many ways, the JCS chairman's role and power in the establishment, in the defense establishment, has been enhanced. And you saw during the Obama administration, very often, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Marty Dempsey, was right by his side, and Obama turned to him quite often for military advice. He had a very powerful role.
But when we do look at this, I mean, one of the things that I interpreted from your book, and help me with this, is that politicians among the soldiers, usually those that are at the height of their leadership, rarely say no to their civilian bosses when they are part of the Joint Chiefs and the chairman, except for Colin Powell, who did fight back over gays in the military. But, you know, is that the emasculation of that, or the politicization of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has that really had a positive or negative role?
Is it the have they been emasculated?
Mm.
Have their influence been dampened? Have they rolled over too quickly? I think, you know, all of the above. You're absolutely right. It was only Colin Powell who really stood up to a president and said no to a president. And that had nothing to do with national security policy. It had to do, or with wars, it had to do with gays in the military. Listen, I think we expect our military officers to, and justly so, we expect them to say yes, sir, and to follow orders. That's what they do. And we should expect that, and they do it. But there have been instances in the past where a military officer has said to the president or said to the Secretary of Defense, yes, sir, of course we'll carry out that order and we'll implement this policy, absolutely. But, sir, if I may make a suggestion, and when we needed the yes, sir, but answer to a president, like during the Iraq War, or staying in Afghanistan to hunt down bin Laden, we have not had the kind of leadership in the military that said, yes, sir, but. And we desperately need that. I don't even think we really have that now. And it shows. We do need military officers who are in the chain of command to insert themselves into policy. Yes, they absolutely should obey orders and implement the policies, but, you know, requiring the military to obey civilians' orders doesn't mean we take away their First Amendment right of freedom of speech. And senior military officers, people with 30, 40 years of experience, should, I think, feel much more free. And I don't know that I'd put this into a law, but they should feel free to stand up and say, this isn't going to work, Mr. President. And we just haven't seen that kind of statement in our military for a long time.
Well, who has let us down more? Is it the civilian leadership? And I haven't been the greatest admirer of some of the political leaders in the recent period, or is it the military in this case? I mean, we all think back to, say, the Civil War, when Lincoln was really guiding a lot of what was going on the battlefield and changing generals because they weren't effective. I mean, what is the proper role? And in this more modern period, who has been more effective, the civilian leadership or the military leadership, or neither?
Well, the quick answer is neither. But you make a terrific point. If I had to choose between civilian leaders and military leaders in picking which one has really fallen down on the job, I'd say the military, frankly. I'm like you. I was never a fan of George Bush's foray into Iraq. And I think the widening conflict and the war on terrorism and the endless nature of it is a bad idea. But I've learned in researching this book that very often, if a military officer stands up and questions, civilian leaders are more than willing to listen carefully. And they will, from time to time, change their minds. We saw this very much so during the Reagan administration, where, you know, Reagan really listened very carefully to what the military had to say, and he made it clear to them that they could play a more open role. And that hasn't really been the case, I don't think, since. We had an incident in the Bush years where the debate was going on, if we remember, about the surge in Iraq, where an Army Chief of Staff, General Schoomaker, mm-hmm. turned to the president, and it's in my book, I catalog this very carefully in my book, but turned to the president and said, "Sir, I just don't think this is going to work." He was Army Chief of Staff. He wasn't Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And he gave his argument to President Bush, and President Bush had a counter-argument to every single point he made. The president came in prepared and had done his homework. And I was really impressed by Bush. You don't have to like or dislike Bush, but you do expect your presidents to be prepared to answer the questions that the military puts to them. And George Bush knew that he was going to be questioned hard by the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he was prepared, and he persuaded them. That's the way it should happen. But it doesn't happen that way often enough, and it hasn't happened, except for that one instance and the Colin Powell instance, in the last 25 or 30 years.
What is the so-called original sin of the war on terrorism? And this goes back to George H.W. Bush.
Yeah, this is when I was researching the book, and I started, you know, I've been hanging around the Defense Department and Pentagon and among military officers for many, many years, but I came across this statement where you hear military officers say, well, what was the original sin in the war on terrorism? How did we, you know, and what they mean by that is, when did we start to get this wrong? How could we fight for 20 years and not yet be winning? And it was a shorthand for, I think, what is now the emerging consensus among military officers. You remember in Operation Desert Storm, the 100-hour war against Saddam Hussein, President Bush, President H.W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, called an end to the war after 100 hours. And the military commanders on the ground in Iraq were really upset and confused because they didn't believe that the job was done. And then after the ceasefire, remember, Saddam Hussein sent his military into southern Iraq, and they perpetrated a slaughter on Iraq's Shia population in southern Iraq. And this was the original sin. We didn't intervene to stop that. We let the slaughter continue. We allowed Saddam Hussein to stay in power. So it was that George H.W. Bush's son, when he said, well, we're going to be greeted, you know, with flowers in southern Iraq, the people of southern Iraq remembered how we had abandoned them. So when I hear military officers say the original sin on the war on terrorism, it's always now a shorthand for that failure to really go get Saddam Hussein when we had him on the ropes and to help the people of southern Iraq against him. Instead, we stood by. That's the original sin on the war on terrorism, and it's caused us enormous heartache throughout the Middle East.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All so right. Well, that sure dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well,
not
you can
us,
direct
though.
Message
we
us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time and will lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
So we started with this original sin as it relates to the war on terror. Where are we today as you see it?
I think that we are still struggling to find a strategy. We are still waiting for our national leaders to stand up and say, here's the goal, here's how long it will take, and here's what it will cost, and here's what victory looks like. We had that during the Cold War. In 1947, top foreign policy thinkers got together in Washington and mapped out how to win the Cold War against Soviet Union. And they thought it would take 40 or 50 years, but that a policy of containment would work. And it did. It was brilliant, and it was well thought through. And we haven't had anything like that in the war on terrorism. Nobody sat down in 1991 or in 2001 and said, all right, what do we have to do? How do we do it? How much will it cost? And what does victory look like? You can walk around Washington now and ask anyone any of those questions, and no one has the answer. And we need the answer. The American people are crying out, I think, to have explained to them what the strategy is for winning and how we'll do it. And until that happens, I think we're kind of groping in the dark, and these wars of uncertain end just continue and become costly, and it's very frustrating. We see this politically all across America, people wondering, you know, when does this end and how do we end it? And those questions haven't been answered.
If we're looking at a foreign policy debate today that is between the notion of offshore balancing versus forward deterrence, explain those concepts briefly and simply to us.
Offshore balancing means that we have strong alliances that we support, but we allow our allies to carry the rifles and carry the fight to the enemy in their own country with our support. And that we do not, offshore balancing means that we do not need to forward deploy our soldiers, sailors, airmen, or women in countries, but we need to build countries' capacity, military capacity to fight the enemies on their own. That's offshore balancing. Forward deterrence is, the shorthand that you hear from the military quite often is forward deterrence means fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them here. The problem with forward deterrence is that it means that American soldiers end up in 80 to 100 countries overseas for an indeterminate amount of time and other nations become dependent on our military power to survive. That's the problem with forward deterrence. The problem with offshore balancing is it really hasn't worked that well. If we were to follow a philosophy of offshore balancing in Afghanistan, we would leave Afghanistan and let that government do the fighting on its own. And the problem is that it would lose. So this is a continuing debate. What strategy do we follow, offshore balancing or forward deterrence? And it's a debate that's kind of you won't find it on the front page of the Washington Post, New York Times, or the Montgomery Advertiser, for that matter. But it's a very strident debate in military circles and in foreign policy circles in Washington.
And the administration in power today, where are they focused? Is there one strategy over another that you can tell in the first 10 months?
Well, I know that Donald Trump campaigned on, I mean, he would never use the term. I'm not even sure he's familiar with it. But I think that he campaigned on the platform of offshore balancing. Let's let them do the fighting. But in fact, in the 10 months of his administration, he's come to depend on forward deterrence. And his national security advisor, General H.R. McMaster, is an advocate for forward deterrence. He believes in fighting them there rather than having to eventually fight them here. I think that's an oversimplification. I think his views are an oversimplification. But he and James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, are very much believers in forward deterrence rather than offshore balancing. So I think that's what we're stuck with.
If neither the civilians or the military have honored themselves in this recent period in terms of what we have done militarily around the world, what do we say about Congress or even the public? Because the War Powers Act and the authorization of force take the place of any serious declaration of war. We as civilians don't think about where we are deployed, even though I think right now we have military deployed in 170 countries. And we're all oblivious to it because it's almost a mercenary force. And most are not touched by it, particularly here in the Northeast where we're emanating from. What do you say about that and our role in all of this?
You're reading my mind because this afternoon I was writing about this very problem. If you go talk to senior military officers now and ask them what the most important event of the last 50 years is, they'll say the end of the Cold War, and they'll be right. If you ask them what the second most important event is, they'll think for a while and they'll say the end of the draft. That is the beginning of the all-volunteer military. It used to be that when you had a draft, if a soldier asked you why he was there, "Hey, Colonel, tell me, why am I in Vietnam?" you felt a requirement to kind of answer him, to explain to him what the national policy was, and to reassure him that the American people and the American government was behind him. Now, if somebody asks you, "Colonel, why am I here?" your answer is, "Because you volunteered. You wanted to do this." I think that the all-volunteer military has kind of skewed the way we as a nation think about war. And, well, there is some disagreement with me on this in strident. I think it's still true. It's made it easier to deploy troops overseas. It's dampened the debate about our foreign policy. It's made it possible for, I'm a Washington Nationals baseball fan. Every fourth inning you stand up and pay homage to our military, and I'm pleased to do that. But it's too easy. These are difficult questions. Foreign policy debates are long and intense, but we don't have them anymore. And one of the reasons that we don't have these intense and deep foreign policy debates is because people who serve in uniform volunteer to be there. And that's that. Nobody's now debating whether we should have a draft, but you do hear hints about it from the military saying, you know, we're going to have to put our military back in touch with the American people. And there's only one way to do that, controversial as it might be, and that's to start a draft.
When we think about the military and the use of the military, that's a very political decision that has to be made. And yet there are certain people who may be absent from that debate, as you suggest, who don't have a stake in all of that. And this is a large part of the American public today. How important is it for us to understand And who better understands the role of politics in military decision making? Is it the military itself, or is it the executive branch? Who really does understand that they are the tip of the spear?
I think the military knows full well they're the tip of the spear. I'll say this, and it's kind of, you know, after writing this book, you sit back. I think all authors do this. You sit back and kind of think through what you said and what you've written, and things emerge during the writing process that aren't there at the beginning. And the one thing that I've concluded is, you know, the United States of America has been very fortunate to have very good leadership when we've needed it. We had George Washington during the Revolutionary War. He was a terrific military leader, not because he fought the British well, but because he refused to fight them in the open, because he'd lose. His job was to survive. In the Civil War, we had, you know, Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant. Once Ulysses S. Grant became head of the armies, there was no question who was going to win the Civil War. We had terrific leadership in World War I on the battlefield. We had terrific leadership in World War II with Marshall and Eisenhower and MacArthur and Roosevelt. So when we've had crises in our country, in foreign policy issues of deep import, we've come up with the leaders who could address them. We haven't done that lately. I suppose after 240 years of this kind of time, we were due for bad leadership. I think that we've had, I say bad leadership, I think we've had indifferent leadership in both the military and the civilian spheres on foreign policy issues for the last 20 years. Very indifferent leadership, and we're suffering for it. We need, you know, someone to emerge, man or woman, who will kind of grab hold of this and say, all right, my fellow Americans, here's what we're going to do, and here's how we're going to do it. And the country is really crying out for that. And when it happens, and it will happen because it's the United States of America, it's always happened, when it happens, it'll make all the difference in the world, and all these questions about what we're doing and why we're doing it will be answered.
Mark, I do have one question for you, but I want to defer to my partner, John Kropczyk, who has a question for you.
Yeah, I have a question. I understand today's military, for every one soldier on the ground, there is 5 to 10 private contractors to back him up. Is this the reason why we're in endless wars, you think? Is this part of it?
I think it is part of it. You know, Eisenhower, well, I mean, this is going to sound like a cliche, and I suppose it is, but the fundamental truth is still there. Eisenhower warned us about the growth and influence of a military-industrial complex, and that's what we're seeing. We don't need 200 trucks for a brigade. We need 70, but we have 200. Why do we have 200? Because of jobs. We have 5 to 10 in back of every soldier, sailor, and airman or woman, other contractors, because that's jobs. We spend $700 billion on our military, and the employment potential and depth in our country of feeding that military complex is very, very significant. And keeping it alive and running and keeping the money flowing is a big part of our problem. And, you know, think of what we could do with a $500 billion military. And I think that, you know, if you want to make the military more efficient, if we really want to do that, there's one way to do it. Cut the defense budget. It's a controversial suggestion, but I think there are a lot of people inside the military who want a streamed-down military and a streamed-down defense budget and kind of a taking apart, an unraveling of the military-industrial complex. The contractor issue that you mentioned is very disturbing for people in the military. After all, World War II, yeah, we had contractors, but the logistics of our military in World War II was handled by the military itself, and that's the way it ought to be now.
In closing, when we go back to the end of the Cold War, and we all remember the Berlin Wall coming down and the excitement that we had beaten back this big bad bear, the Soviet Union. When we look back at that, and then we look at this period that we're in with endless wars and indeterminate ends and so forth, How will history judge this period? Is it one of the big elements of our foreign policy that we've squandered in our history?
Yes, I think we've squandered it. I think historians 200 years from now will say, gee, the United States had it. They were the world's leading economy and its military. And what did they do? They overreached. They took on problems that they had no hope of resolving. I can remember in the mid-1980s talking to Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, and I had 15 minutes with him, ended up 45 minutes, and I said, he asked me what I was most disturbed about in the Department of Defense, and I said, you're spending a lot of money on weapons. You're spending a huge amount on weapons. And he looked at me and he shook his head and he said, oh, Mark, he said, listen to me, we're not spending money on weapons in order to use them. We're spending money on weapons so we don't have to. And it seemed to me that, you know, here we are now. We're spending a lot of money in our military because we're using it. We're overusing it. And, you know, this is other arms of our government, diplomacy, foreign aid, the use of non-governmental organizations has atrophied as a result. We open the toolbox now, and the biggest tool in the toolbox is a hammer, so we take it out and we use it. And it's a mistake. Historians will say 50 years from now, 5 years from now, 200 years from now, the United States overreached. And this is the era that we're in. We're in the era of military overreach.
Mark Perry, I can't thank you enough for coming by today on America Trends Podcast. The book is called The Pentagon Wars, The Military's Undeclared War Against America's Presidents. Very insightful. Thank you for coming by.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.